Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. The Texas Rangers were unofficially created in 1823 by Stephen F. Austin and have undergone many changes throughout the years. Those who work for the Texas Department of Public Safety aspire to be a part of the Rangers. However, just like any law enforcement agency, even some of the Texas Rangers elite can be swayed to take shortcuts or even be racist, which can send innocent men and women to death row. For example, when Christine Morton was bludgeoned to death on August 13, 1986, officers quickly honed in on her husband, although the couple's three-year-old son had seen the attacker and said it was not his father. Michael Morton was quickly railroaded and sentenced to life in prison, mainly because of prosecutorial abuse. He was released after 25 years in prison, and the Michael Morton Act was created in Texas. This is just one example of an innocent man being sentenced to life or death for horrific crimes they did not commit. Okay, on to the show. Clarence Brandley was born on September 24, 1951, in Montgomery, Texas. He lived most of his adult life in Conroe, Texas, 40 miles north of Houston. His parents were Willie and Minnie, and he had numerous siblings, Ozell, Timothy, Alice, and Margaret. He also had five children. Although there is no mention of Brandley's childhood, we do know Conroe is a place with a horribly violent racial history. The first recorded black man who was a victim of racial violence in Conroe was Bennett Jackson, a 19-year-old farm laborer. One day, when a white farmer came home and found his wife and two children beaten and bloodied on the floor, Jackson was accused, taken to a jail cell, but then collected later. He was taken into the woods, where he was kept until almost noon the next day. There is no record of what transpired in those woods. When he was brought back the next day, a noose was slipped over his head, then the rope thrown over a tree limb, before being tied off on a horse's saddle. The horse was sent off, and Jackson was soon dead. Then, even more notoriously, in 1922, Joe Winters was also a victim of racial violence. Winters lived in the black part of Conroe, worked at the sawmills, and was married to a woman named Anna. He also had a white girlfriend. A lot of people in the black community knew about the affair, but no one in the white community did. One Friday afternoon, they were discovered by a white man. In her fear, the white woman cried, "Rape!" A posse was formed and men searched the streets of Conroe, entering homes in an effort to find Winters. The next day, men from around the county had joined in the search. By this time, several thousand white men were looking for Joe and using bloodhounds to track him. They followed his scent to a mile west of town, where the scent went cold. They soon heard that he had been seen on the east side of town, so they headed that way. They found him on May 20th, 1922, just before 4 o'clock p.m. They then dragged him back into the city square. Only white faces, hundreds of them, filled the square. The sheriff's men had the roads blocked to prevent the black community from coming into the square. Winters was in chains when they dragged him through the crowd. He was chained to an iron post at the end of the fence, which ran around the gleaming courthouse. Men brought old boxes and built a pyre around Winters' head. They then poured oil and kerosene over the boxes until they were soaked. Then someone struck a match, and all of the people who had showed up watched as Winters burned alive. There were other men killed in Conroe, mainly because of their race. Clem Scott was hanged from an elm tree in the square. Tom Payne was hanged on the edge of town after the police handed him over to the mob. James Kinder and Al Friley were shot in the street by a crowd of white people. An unknown black man was shot in the head for allegedly prowling by a white woman's house. Warren Lewis, who was developmentally disabled, was hanged from a tree because he went to a white woman's house to ask for water. Bob White was a black man accused of raping a white woman. His trial was moved to Conroe as part of a change of venue, and while in court, her husband crept up behind him and shot him in the head. This was after White had been tied to a tree for a week and whipped with a rubber hose until he signed a confession. The husband was later acquitted of murder. Charles Brandley lived a seemingly quiet life and was a war veteran. He worked part-time at a mortuary and full-time as a high school supervising custodian at Conroe High School. However, on March 7, 1979, Brandley was allegedly arrested for an attempted rape and abduction. He was also on probation for a felony weapons charge. On August 30, 1980, Brandley arrived to work around 7:40 a.m. That day, he was working with four other custodians, Gary Ackerman, Henry Icky Peace, John Sessom, and Sam Martinez. After Brandley arrived to work and unlocked the doors, he helped Icky Peace carry a buffer to the teacher's lounge. A volleyball scrimmage game was being played there at Conroe High School. Some of the custodians were setting up chairs in the cafeteria. A young, pretty blonde girl came up the stairs looking for a restroom, and in most accounts, Ackerman told her where to find the restroom. Brandley came up the stairs right after that with toilet paper, and Ackerman told him that there was a girl in the restroom. Brandley replied that he was going to the men's restroom instead. He sent the remaining custodians across the street to the vocational building and said he would be over soon to unlock the door. Allegedly, the men waited on Brandley, but he never showed. In many of their statements, it was 45 minutes later when he came out of his office with a towel around his neck. He told the men they could go home. However, Peace was giving Brandley a ride home, and before they left, some girls began looking for the missing girl. The girls described what their teammate looked like. Brandley and Peace assisted in the search. Peace noticed that the outside door near the auditorium and the door leading into the auditorium were open, so the two men decided to check there. Brandley said she might be in the loft above the auditorium, so Peace checked there while Brandley searched around the seats. They could not find anything, so they searched elsewhere. They searched the area three times, and at approximately 11:30 a.m., found the nude body of Cheryl Ferguson, age 16, hidden under some plywood in the loft area. Ferguson only had socks on, but her clothes could not be found. She had been strangled. The autopsy would later show that it was with something like a towel or a belt, and she had been raped. The autopsy also revealed that her bladder was empty, indicating that she likely had made it to the restroom. Cheryl was the manager for the Belleville High School volleyball team. Their team had arrived around 9:30 that morning, and shortly after arriving, she left her belongings and went to the restroom close to the auditorium. Cheryl was a daughter of Cleveland Lee Buck Ferguson, who was once a bull rider on the rodeo circuit and later in life became an artist. Unfortunately, not much is known about Cheryl's all-too-brief life, other than her mother Sylvia passed away from cancer the year before. After they discovered the girl's body, Brandley and Peace contacted the Conroe Police Department. On the 25th, Cheryl's clothes were found in a dumpster behind the school. Brandley was taken to Houston to have a polygraph test administered. The examiner of that test had 16 years' experience, and he told the officer who brought Brandley that Brandley passed the polygraph and had nothing to do with the crime. School was scheduled to start on August 31st, so the authorities promised an arrest before then. The local police contacted the Texas Rangers and asked for assistance, and Ranger Wesley Stiles was called in from vacation to go to Conroe. Stiles met with Brandley and Peace first, since they had found the body, and said to them, quote, "One of you is going to hang for this." Then he turned to Brandley. "Since you're the N-word, you're elected." Brandley was the only black custodian employed at the high school. Stiles reviewed Brandley's polygraph exam and quickly determined that Brandley had actually failed the polygraph exam. No interviews were conducted of the other custodians, and on August 29th, one day after he arrived in Conroe, Stiles arrested Clarence of the rape and murder of Cheryl Ferguson. According to Brandley, in an interview with 1 for 10, suspects would usually be taken under the garage and out of the public eye, but they walked Brandley across the street where all the media were taking pictures. He stated it was almost like a show. Brandley said they took him to an interrogation room and kept him there for 5 hours and tried to coerce a confession from him. He kept protesting his innocence and gave his full cooperation, even though he knew he was a scapegoat. Brandley alleged that they were manipulating the evidence from the beginning, and he stated, quote, they had people come forward and testify and lie. On August 30th, Stiles met with Ackerman, Sessom, and Martinez at the school and interviewed them. The interview consisted of a walkthrough of the school while Ackerman explained what happened. Two of them said that they saw Branly follow Cheryl up the stairs to the loft and did not see him again until the search for her began. There was no physical evidence that linked Branly to the crime. A vaginal swab was done and semen had been recovered from her body. However, during the autopsy, it was discovered that Cheryl's hymen was still intact. Three Caucasian hairs were found near Cheryl's vagina, although two hairs consistent with Branly's were found on Cheryl's socks. If she was dragged into the loft, these could have easily been transferred from the floor. Other findings of the autopsy included bruises on her triceps and heels of her hands under each thumb, cuts on her knees, and one near the top of her shoulder. There was a 4.5-inch U-shaped abrasion across the front of her neck. Her fingernails were clean and unbroken, indicating that she had not fought back or had been restrained before having a chance to fight back. Her underwear tested positive for semen, indicating that she had them on during the attack. Her clothes were cut off, but Branly and Peace's knives did not have clothing fibers on them. There were mop fibers found on Cheryl's clothes, which gave credence to the theory that it was one of the janitors who attacked her. Branly's trial was held in December 1980. The jury was all white because allegedly the prosecutor's handbook said they couldn't use black jurors in a trial. Branly's four co-workers all testified. One juror said that there was not enough evidence to support a guilty verdict, so this led to a hung jury. This one juror faced a lot of harassment after the trial and was called many things, including an N-word lover. The second trial began on January 29, 1981. Again, there was an all-white jury. The prosecution struck every black person who was qualified. Throughout the trial, there was an elderly, white, well-dressed lady in the courtroom who would whisper, "Kill the N-word. Kill the N-word." The defense posited that due to the bruises on her triceps, they believed that two people participated in the attack. The bruising suggested that someone held her from the back. The prosecution alleged that Branly killed Cheryl, then raped her. He used a towel from around his neck to clean up the crime and tossed her clothes in the dumpster. He opened the doors to the auditorium to make it look like someone came in from the outside and then made sure Peace found the body, so Peace would get the blame. John Sessom did not testify at the second trial because he said he would no longer support the other custodian's story. The three hairs found near Cheryl's vagina were found to be inconsistent with Branly's hair. During closing arguments, the DA said that Branly's part-time job at a funeral home suggested that he was a necrophiliac, and this is why he had sex with Cheryl after she was already dead. The defense objected, but the judge overruled it. The jury deliberated just 45 minutes before they found Branly guilty of capital murder and sentenced him to death. The judge told Clarence that he was guilty. He hoped Clarence would be at peace and that he hoped God would bless Clarence. Then he set an execution date. Clarence provided an insight into death row. He said they cut off all your hair, shave your head, and everything else. Then they spray you like animals and give you a number. Then you are transported out to death row. Clarence said that it felt like he was going to hell. Clarence always had faith and hope that one day someone, somewhere, was going to look at the evidence and realize that he had nothing to do with the crime. 11 months after his sentencing, his attorneys began filing appeals. They realized that exculpatory evidence had disappeared from the prosecution's custody. The semen from her underwear and the vaginal swabs were missing, along with the Caucasian hairs and the other hairs that did not match Cheryl or Branly. There were also blood samples missing. Some of these samples had not been tested for various reasons. The appellate attorneys also found that some of the evidence contradicted what the prosecutors had predicted, such as pictures taken the day of the homicide and rape. Branly was not wearing the belt that prosecutors claimed he used to kill Cheryl. But even with the new evidence, the Texas Court of Appeals denied his appeal, stating that the evidence was sufficient to support the original guilty verdict. In 1986, Brenda Medina heard about the Branley case and realized it sounded eerily familiar. She called the DA to report that her former live-in boyfriend, James Dexter Robinson, woke her up in the middle of the night on August 23, 1980, and admitted to her that he had committed a murder and rape. He told her that he had hidden the body so well that there would be time for him to gather his stuff and get out of state before anyone found it. She didn't believe him. She thought he was trying to scare her, but when she woke up, James was gone, and there was a pair of blood-spattered shoes, which she threw away. At the time, Medina was 16 and pregnant with his child. She was used to his lies and thought this was yet another one told to get away from the responsibility of taking care of his child. Medina had been raped by Robinson, but she didn't want to explain that to her parents, so she moved in with him. Brenda also reported that Robinson frequently beat her. In March of 1980, Robinson, who was 19, won an annulment of his October 1979 marriage to Bertie Allen Bridges of South Carolina. Her lawyer wrote to Robinson's lawyer on her behalf stating that she was, quote, mentally challenged and not overly aware of her legal rights. Her lawyer said that Bertie was pregnant and expected child support. She was in Greenville General Hospital being treated for a spleen injury that her attorney surmised may be the result of repeated beatings given to her by Robinson. Medina also reported that she came home one day to find Ackerman there with Robinson, and the two men taking turns having sex with a woman handcuffed to the bed. Ackerman did admit to hanging out with Robinson on occasion, but they both denied this incident occurred. Robinson was the former head janitor's son. When Branley took over from the previous janitor, all keys were supposed to be turned over to Branley, but one set was missing. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. The DA did not believe Medina's story and claimed she was untrustworthy, and therefore they had no obligation to report her story to the defense of Branley. Medina saw an attorney who had her contact Branley's attorney directly. Medina took a polygraph test and passed it. Additionally, she completed and signed a sworn statement. With this new information in hand, the defense attorneys went to the Texas Board of Appeals and petitioned for a writ of habeas corpus. The court responded by calling for an evidentiary hearing. At this evidentiary hearing, Medina testified as to what Robinson had told her. Ackerman testified that James Robinson had been at the school that morning. Robinson also took a polygraph, and when asked if he had killed Cheryl Ferguson, Robinson delayed for 4.5 minutes and then said he couldn't remember. Robinson had allegedly been in South Carolina at the time of the crime. But Reginald T. Slocum Jr., a former high school janitor, noted that Robinson was in town for at least 2 weeks after the date he said he had allegedly left. Sessom also testified at this evidentiary hearing and stated that he had watched Ackerman climb the stairs after Cheryl Ferguson that morning. Robinson was with his friend, Ackerman. He then heard Cheryl screaming, but later Gary told Sessom not to tell anyone what he had seen. Sessom told Ranger Stiles about what he had seen, but Stiles told Sessom he would arrest him if his story did not match the other custodians. Branley was still denied a new trial. Around the time of the 1987 evidentiary hearing, black citizens of Conroe began protesting Branley's innocence. One of these, a rather prominent citizen, was Judon Boney Jr., who was a member of the Houston City Council from 1995 to 2001, representing the historically black District D. Judon Boney organized a coalition to free Clarence Branley, a multiracial alliance of Houstonians that successfully galvanized support for Branley's release. Judon Boney was an ordained Baptist minister and was also mayor pro tem for Houston, serving with the city's first black mayor, Lee P. Brown. Boney held a mock funeral at Conroe in front of the courthouse to represent the death of the justice system. Boney and Ozell Branley, Clarence's brother, appeared on an episode of Houston AM. A juror called in to talk about the case and said she did not know anything about the polygraph exam that Branley had taken. She said she was upset because she did her civic duty, but just got lambasted for it. Boney asked her what evidence persuaded her that Branley was guilty, and she could not remember, so he lambasted her for that. A lady named Gwen, claiming to be Cheryl Ferguson's sister-in-law, called into the show and said that this young girl has a name, and her name is Cheryl. It's very painful to the family that this has become a racial issue, when the problem is a girl is dead, and something needs to be done. Gwen would not comment on how she felt, but stated that the family believed Branley was guilty. She stated that there were real people involved. Gwen admitted that the family was biased regarding Clarence Branley. According to Judon Boney, the DA allegedly stated he deliberately disqualified blacks because he did not believe that black jurors could be objective in the ruling. With his execution date getting closer and closer, the Branley family reached out to Jim McCloskey, who had founded the Centurion Ministries in the early 1980s to free people who were wrongfully convicted and imprisoned. He joined Branley's legal team and they began working to free Branley. Additionally, the FBI became involved due to the blatant racism that they discovered in the first two trials. Branley was given a stay 5 days before his execution was set to occur. McCloskey reached out to Sessom and scheduled an interview with Harry Reasoner of the TV show 60 Minutes. Sessom admitted that he had witnessed Ferguson's abduction and said on camera that James Robinson was the man who had killed Cheryl. Sessom said he finally had to tell the truth about Branley. McCloskey next went to Ackerman and told him that Sessom had spilled the beans, and Ackerman's hand started shaking so badly that McCloskey had to light his cigarette for him and then hand it to him. On the same episode of 60 Minutes, Ackerman also states that he saw Robinson force Cheryl into the bathroom. Ackerman said Cheryl was screaming no and help. 60 Minutes aired their piece in early April, and 2 weeks later, things began to change. Within 3 to 4 weeks, the case had been resurrected. Even the prison guards supported Branley. Also in April 1987, Edward Glenn Payne Sr. spoke to an author from Texas Monthly regarding the Clarence Branley case. Payne had to use an electrolarynx machine to talk in order to compensate for the larynx he lost to throat cancer. Payne's son-in-law was Gary Ackerman. Payne recounted a conversation he had with Ackerman one weekend not long after Cheryl's rape and murder. 10 days before the interview, Payne had been beaten by two unknown assailants who warned him to keep his goddamn mouth shut. In early June of 1987, Ackerman had served a short jail term on unrelated charges. When he finished the sentence, he returned home to Payne's daughter Cynthia and the Ackerman's children, all of whom lived next door to Payne. Around the time that Ackerman moved back in, Branley's attorney made Payne's statement public, although he later recanted it. When Tom Curtis met with Payne, he said the attorneys had told him what to say. Payne told police in 1986 that Ackerman reportedly knew where Cheryl's clothes were before they were found. A change of venue hearing was held in Conroe, Texas on September 21, 1987. The KKK burned a cross on the outskirts of Conroe the night before the change of venue hearing. At the hearing, the judge took his pipe out of his mouth and said, "Son, what you're seeing is a First Amendment freedom of speech at play." The second evidentiary hearing was held in Galveston, Texas on September 28, 1987. Witness after witness presented themselves with new evidence, including two young ladies who worked at a taxi service in Conroe, who said that Ackerman had told them he knew who had killed Cheryl, but he would never tell. During the second evidentiary hearing, it was revealed that most of the statements that were provided by the custodians for the first and second trial were coerced by Ranger Wesley Stiles, particularly Henry Icky Peace. Peace testified that Stiles arrived at his house one night and pushed him against the wall, choked him by twisting the chain around his neck, and then made him go to the station with him. While there, he asked repeatedly to be allowed to contact his family or an attorney, but was denied this request. Stiles said he could not leave until he had signed a written statement. Unfortunately, Peace could not read or write, but again, he was not allowed a family member to assist. He eventually initialed the statement so he could leave. He also related how Stiles threatened to blow his brains out on the way to the station. Stiles testified at the evidentiary hearing that he had made up his mind before he ever arrived in Conroe. He had a blind focus on Branley, and even though the pubic hairs were Caucasian, he still believed it was Branley. Therefore, he refused to take samples of the other janitor's hair or blood, even though blood type A was found on Cheryl's shirt and Branley was type O. Additionally, the state failed to follow up on a tip from Cheryl Bradford, who was also playing volleyball the day Cheryl Ferguson was raped and murdered. Bradford passed the victim in the hallway as Bradford was returning from the restroom. 20 to 30 minutes later, she saw two white men rushing through the gym, which was noticeable since there were no men at the scrimmage. After Ferguson's body was found, Bradford told her coach what she had seen, and they contacted the Conroe Police Department. The judge concluded after hearing 46 defense witnesses and a handful of prosecution witnesses that Clarence was innocent. The judge ruled this as a finding fact. The judge also ruled as a finding fact that Gary Akerman and James Dexter Robinson committed this crime. Clarence began to cry. His fight was not over. It would be two more years before he walked off death row as a free man. During this time, the Coalition to Free Clarence Branley met at the Shape Community Center every Tuesday night. Deloyd Parker was the executive director of the Shape Center. On December 13, 1989, he was released on a $75,000 bond. He had spent 9 years, 5 months, and 23 days behind bars. Nearly seven of those years were on death row. He walked out at 1:15 p.m. on a Tuesday. The Coalition to Free Clarence Branley was meeting that night, so he attended. Charges against Branley were eventually dropped in October of 1990. In the fall of 2014, the Conroe Police Department said they had no intention of reopening the case. Akerman and Robinson remained free, although a judge had said they were the ones who were guilty of the crime. Charles became an ordained minister, but had difficulty finding decent jobs. He married, and then he and his children filed lawsuits against the state of Texas for compensation for unlawful imprisonment. These suits were denied due to the statute of limitations, and because Charles was neither pardoned or found not guilty. Ironically, Branley's fight to be exonerated had paved the way for special funding for others like him, but he was denied these funds. He became one of the first death row prisoners to be released from death row. He was also the first person in Texas to be indicted for capital murder and go to trial within 90 days. Buck Ferguson, Cheryl's father, remarried and opened a specialty shop for his art designs. In 2001, he was inducted into the Texas Cowboy Hall of Fame for bull riding. Buck did not believe that Charles was innocent. He was not angry over his release because he felt that politics played a great part into it. His biggest concern was that people had forgotten all about Cheryl and the fight for Branley's release. Cleveland Lee Buck Ferguson passed away on February 13, 2010. Wesley Stiles was a revered Texas Ranger, although the Branley case did cast something of a shadow on his distinguished career. He passed away on September 2, 1998, after serving 30 years as a Ranger. Ickey Peace was charged with 5 counts of sexual abuse on a child in a neighboring county in 1989. Charles Branley passed away on September 2, 2018. Jim McCloskey had this to say when he died. Clarence Branley was one of the bravest men I have ever known. He never panicked and stood calm and strong as a rock in the face of almost certain knowledge that he very well might be executed for a crime he did not commit. He came very close to that fate and faced it with a quiet dignity and courage that inspired all of us feverishly working to save him. His coolness under fire kept our hands steady on the till. Life was not easy for Clarence during the last 28 years. He tried his hand in different pursuits, including becoming an ordained Baptist minister. He was a private man who kept his wounds to himself. During the last decade or so of his life, he lived a very quiet life in the country with his beloved companion, Dorothy Moore. For many years, he was invited to participate on speaking panels in the U.S. and Great Britain. With his passing, he now rests in peace with his Lord, who I am sure welcomes him to an eternal life full of unconditional love. In January 2018, before Charles passed away, former Conroe Police Department Chief Charlie Ray died. When his relatives began going through his belongings, they found a box of trial exhibits in his garage. Curtis Montgomery County District Attorney Brett Ligon called in the Texas Rangers and the local police department to analyze the evidence that is left. Maybe justice will be served for Cheryl and Charles after all. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. Music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Content warning at the top of the show was provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast. Research was conducted by Haley Gray, host of the Murder Road Trip podcast. This episode was written by Susie St. James. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friend shows.
From January 1st, 1976, through the end of March 1977, the Metro Detroit area was the site of 9 child murders. 3 of those cases are resolved, but the other 6 cases remain open, with most of these deaths attributed to the as-yet unidentified Oakland County child killer. Don't Talk to Strangers is a long-form podcast focused on this series of unresolved child murders. Join us as we explore the stories of these young victims, the impact on their families and the community, and what happened to the investigation into these crimes. Subscribe to Don't Talk to Strangers on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher.
Friends tired of hearing you talk about serial killers?
While you're at a dinner party, have you randomly blurted out the odds of being murdered by a complete stranger?
Does Netflix only recommend documentaries on true crime and murder?
If you've answered yes to one or more of these questions,
come over and sit at our friends table.
I'm Cam.
And I'm Jen.
And we are the co-host of our true crime podcast.
And you can listen to us every Wednesday wherever you download your podcasts.
See you on Wednesday. Oh, bye-bye.
Love ya.